Two more Democrats join the presidential race. Two others take their names out of consideration. And is the president still talking at CPAC? It's a filibuster edition of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. President Trump, spurned by Michael Cohen and Kim Jong-un, found lots of love at CPAC.
He was in a room with people who like him, and there is a feeling in the West Wing that the boss got a lot out and vented a lot of steam. But I can tell you, aides were shocked that he went on and on for over 2 hours. That was not the plan.
Plus, Colorado's John Hickenlooper becomes the 14th Democrat to announce for president. Is the party ready for a centrist?
He does a great job of bringing people to the table and really listening to a lot of different perspectives, making people feel heard and understanding where they're coming from. That can really tone down some of the anger when people have that really productive dialogue.
And we head to New Hampshire, where potential Trump challengers are taking the temperature of the party.
Bill Weld, one of the reasons he's starting to make the rounds is to encourage and give courage to other candidates who might be thinking the same thing. He's sticking his neck out, he knows that, and he's hoping that he won't be alone on the campaign trail.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 267 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The media may still be focused on Joe Biden. Will he or won't he? But other Democrats are not waiting around for his answer. The number of candidates in the race is now up to 14, with the entrance in the last few days of Jay Inslee of Washington State and John Hickenlooper of Colorado. Biden has been sending out smoke signals for months that his family's on board. He's just waiting for the right time. And while his reputation as someone who can work with Republicans sounds good on paper, not everyone is happy about it. He's still getting heat from his appearance at an event in Michigan last fall, where he praised Republican Congressman Fred Upton. At the time, Upton was in a dead heat with his Democratic opponent, but Biden, in his speech, called Upton one of the finest guys I ever worked with. Upton won his re-election by 4 percentage points, and local Democrats were livid. And Cynthia Nixon, the actress activist, tore into Biden in a Washington Post op-ed for a recent comment where he called Vice President Mike Pence a decent guy. That was too much for Nixon, an LGBTQ activist who recounted Pence's history of fighting gay rights. There is a sense among genteel Washington that partisanship is rude and boorish, Nixon wrote. But when you're fighting for the rights of marginalized communities who are under attack, it's okay to stop being polite. This is not a time for hollow civility. This is a time to fight. Biden later realized his mistake. In a tweet, he wrote, "There is nothing decent about being anti-LGBTQ rights, and that includes the vice president." So that's the mood of the Democratic Party as Biden gets closer to making his decision. Meanwhile, some of the big news this week was made by Democrats who decided they weren't running for president. On Monday, Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley sent out a 4-minute video filled with biographical details.
According to family lore, my grandmother lived for a time in a boxcar. My dad overcame an illness as a teenager that left him hospitalized for a year, but he grew up to live a full life as a husband, a father, and a union machinist. My family story is a story of America creating opportunity. I still live in the same blue-collar neighborhood.
Only to say,
today, I'm announcing that I am not running for president. I believe that there are Democrats now in the presidential race who are speaking to the importance of tackling the big challenges we face.
Merkley said he would seek a third term in the Senate. Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, who has also been teasing about running for president for several cycles as a moderate, announced on Tuesday he's staying out of it as well. Bloomberg, who quit the Democratic Party in 2001 to run for mayor as a Republican, then while in office switched to independent and finally back to the Democrats, said he will focus instead on clean energy and climate change initiatives. And finally, Eric Holder, who was the Attorney General under President Obama, said he too won't be running. I don't know how many people were ready to get behind a Holder for President campaign, but at least his decision leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the last person elected president whose only public office was being a member of the cabinet? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. Last week may not have been the most successful of Donald Trump's presidency. His character and integrity were ripped to shreds by his former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, in a nationally televised House committee hearing. Trump had high hopes for some major breakthrough with Kim Jong-un during their summit in Hanoi, but that failed to materialize. What he came home to, though, was, well, surreal. He went straight to a love fest at CPAC, where he gave a rambling two-hour-plus speech that the audience ate up. That was followed just a few days later with an order by the House Judiciary Committee for documents from 81 of his associates, a list that includes his two sons, son-in-law Jared Kushner, the Trump campaign, the Trump Organization, the Trump Foundation, Roger Stone, Steve Bannon, Julian Assange, Hope Hicks, Carter Page. You get the picture. Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler was asked on CNN what the purpose of such a wide list was.
Well, our goal is to hold the administration accountable for the obstruction of justice, the abuse of power, and the corruption. Our goal is to vindicate the rule of law, to protect the rule of law in this country. And that's our core function as the Judiciary Committee of the Congress.
John Bennett is the White House correspondent for Roll Call and joins us now to sum up the president's week. John, what a week. What a week.
It was quite a week. I talked earlier this week with a Republican strategist who's pretty plugged into things. And he, in his words, quote, it was probably the worst week of his presidency, and that's saying something, end quote.
If there was ever proof that elections have consequences, just watch what the Democrats are doing in the House.
That's right. We've seen, Elijah Cummings, he's the chairman of the House Oversight and Reform Committee. He asked for information last week surrounding Jared Kushner's security clearance and how he actually obtained that after at least a year of being rejected. We saw Jerry Nadler, who is the new chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, earlier this week, that he sent letters to 81 individuals and entities, either Trump associates, former staffers, current staffers in the West Wing, different agencies within the government and the White House itself, demanding reams and reams of documents. Both those committees and the House Intelligence Committee are going to be requesting at least interviews with a lot of those folks and the more high-profile folks. They may even have to subpoena their testimony. That includes his children.
Well, you know, when I listened to Nadler talk about what his goal is, it almost sounds like he's making the case or at least listing potential articles of impeachment, even though that's a word that Democrats don't like to say out loud.
You know, that's a very good point. Listening and kind of reading the transcripts and reading Nadler's statements over and over and listening to him talk, he does kind of talk out of both sides of his mouth. Like you said, in so many words, he walks right up to the precipice of saying he's looking to build articles of impeachment. And then in the very next breath, he says he has a very high bar for impeachment. So it's hard to get a sense of where this is headed with the House Democrats. I mean, you've got some of the new members even this week when asked about all this. And some of these new members from the more progressive or liberal wing of the party saying that, you know, while they personally think there's enough evidence before their colleagues even launch, much less finish these investigations for impeachment, impeachment proceedings at least, they're now saying they defer to leadership. So Democrats are trying to walk a tightrope because this could backfire, just like it backfired on Republicans in the 90s when they did not have the votes in the Senate to remove President Clinton, but they were just hell-bent on going ahead in the House with impeachment, and it ended up biting them. And Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer and even Nadler and Cummings, you know, those folks have been around a while. They saw all that. They don't want to repeat it, but there's going to be pressure from that part of their base for impeachment. And I think that will pick up whenever Bob Mueller, the special counsel, releases his report, which, depending on who's speaking, could be tomorrow or could be 3 months from now.
Well, regarding the request for documents from 81 individuals and entities, I would say that Trump's response was predictable.
There was no collusion. That was a hoax. There was no anything. And they want to do that instead of getting legislation passed. 81 people or organizations got letters. It's a disgrace. It's a disgrace to our country. I'm not surprised that it's happening. Basically, they've started the campaign. So the campaign begins. But the campaign's actually, their campaign's been going on for the last 2.5 years. So it's a shame. And the people understand it. When they look at it, they just say presidential harassment.
This is what the president is going to do. He's going to punch back. He's going to push the bounds of true statements. He's going to utter false statements. He's going to utter blind allegations. And he's going to try to keep that conservative base fired up because he has no shot of reelection without them. And remember here, the office of the presidency has myriad legal protections for the incumbent. And I don't, with all these investigations, and don't forget the Southern District of New York, the federal prosecutors there, state prosecutors are looking into his businesses, the campaign. There's every reason for President Trump to keep fighting back and keep those legal protections as long as he can.
Well, he didn't have to do much fighting when he got to CPAC last weekend. It was an almost out of this world happening. First of all, he gets on the podium. He, the president, gets on the podium and he hugs the American flag, which is just, you know, I mean, it was a beautiful love story. But and then he speaks for more than 2 hours.
Yes, just an incredible thing to watch on Saturday. Now he has hugged the flag a few times before. That was not completely new. And remember, this is a former reality television star. He always knows his audience, and he plays to his audience. And he's done that with friendly audiences before. You know, he was venting, and I talked to a senior White House official about this, and this official did not discount the fact that the boss had a bad week, a very bad week last week. He was in a room with people who like him, and as the official said, quote, that's a very good feeling, end quote. So there is a feeling in the West Wing that the boss got a lot out and vented a lot of steam on Saturday. But I can tell you aides were shocked that he went on and on for over two hours. That was not the plan.
I mean, I read somewhere that it was the longest speech ever given by an American president. They said it was even longer than William Henry Harrison's inaugural address in 1841, which, as you know, was 8,445 words. And you know what happened to poor Bill. You know, he didn't last that long afterwards. And someone wrote on social media that the speech lasted longer than Trump's first two marriages. I don't know if that's true, but it's just pretty remarkable. Well, you know, it was a lot about Comey. It was a lot about bad trade deals. It was a lot about crooked Hillary. He even had a thing about that his election was more significant than Andrew Jackson's. And he said, well, other people have said that. I didn't say that. I love what he does. I mean, I didn't say it, but other people have said that it was more important than Andrew Jackson's. He even talked about the size of the inauguration.
You know, the same official, and at this point some other reporters had joined in this conversation, the same official kept telling us that there was not that much new in the president's remarks on Saturday, but there was no, I mean, you can't really discount the fact that his delivery and his demeanor were different. And, you know, I noticed, you know, the president had the upper lip sweat going at several moments, and he appeared to be just very animated. And the official did not discount the fact that, again, that the president had a bad week and that he was just getting it out. So while, you know, we've heard a lot of what he said before, you know, the profanity was new. We know the president, I mean, a lot of presidents curse behind the scenes. President Obama said one of his regrets was he cursed too much behind the scenes. So we know President Trump does that. We don't really hear a lot of that in public. He dropped BS a couple times. There were some other words that he used. And I just found that very telling. But again, being able to watch this as a somewhat normal person and not a reporter who had to write a story after the president was finished.
But they fight so hard on this witch hunt, this phony deal that they put together, this phony thing that now looks like it's dying, so they don't have anything with Russia. There's no collusion. So now they go and morph into, let's inspect every deal he's ever done. We're going to go into his finances. We're going to check his deals. We're going to check. These people are sick. They're sick. But we had the greatest of all time. Now we have people that lost. And unfortunately, you put the wrong people in a couple of positions, and they leave people for a long time that shouldn't be there. And all of a sudden, they're trying to take you out with okay?
The audience loved it.
They sure did. They, as the old saying goes, they ate up most of what he had to say, especially those lines. You just have to look at polling to see that is a very conservative audience that gathers outside of Washington each year for that conference. And it's, you know, it's someone told me, I don't remember who at the moment, that, you know, that's kind of kind of going to Mecca, for lack of a better term. He knows that he needs to have a strong performance there. And boy, I think the president definitely met that standard on Saturday.
Well, I agree. I mean, look, I mean, obviously the president needed it, especially after the Michael Cohen hearing and coming away from Hanoi empty-handed. But, and he's also going to, looks like he's going to have a fight on his decision to use emergency powers to get his money for the border wall. Senator Rand Paul has indicated that he's going to join three other Republicans, Susan Collins, Tom Tillis, and Lisa Murkowski, to vote to overturn Trump's decision. Now, I know Paul has often bluffed about opposing the president, but this time he may stick to his guns. And then there may be other Republicans who vote no as well. Now, I know if the Senate joins the House, which has already gone on record opposing Trump's decision, the president said he'll veto the legislation, and no one thinks that Congress has enough votes to override the veto. But it sends a signal from a Congress that for the first, you know, after the first 2 years, when everything was going along the way Trump wanted, things have clearly changed.
It's going to pass the Senate. There's reporting today and yesterday that there could be up to 14 Republican defections. So this is going to be a rebuke of the president and his national emergency at the border. But there aren't votes in the House to override his veto, and there aren't going to be 67 votes in the Senate. There have been warnings from the president and some of his top aides that, you know, if some of these, especially Republican senators, vote for the resolution, so that means against the national emergency, there could be ramifications for their reelection campaigns. A lot of these Republican senators are up next time.
Primary challenges, like Tom Tillis, I think, was threatened in North Carolina.
That's right. That's right. And the fear has always been, because Trump remains so popular with the conservative base, that if you step out of line too many times or on the wrong issue, that the president, who I think we can say can be a pretty vindictive fella, that he will go and he will order his political folks to find a conservative challenger for some of these Republican senators who can at least give them a scare, or in some cases, just look at Jeff Flake and just look at Bob Corker. They were in the Senate in early January, and on January 3rd, they were no longer in the Senate because of just that.
John Bennett is the White House correspondent for Roll Call. John, it was great having you on the program.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You talk too much. You worry me to death. You talk too much. You even worry my pet. You just talk. Talk too much. You talk about people that you don't know. You talk about people wherever you go. You just talk. Talk too much.
The women and the people of color have had their say. Now it's time for the white guys. Two new candidates have thrown their hats in the Democratic presidential ring, both from the West, one a governor and one a former governor. Neither one is widely known. We'll have two reports, one on Washington Governor Jay Inslee and one on former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper. We'll start with Hickenlooper. As Democratic Party voters and some of its candidates have moved to the left, Hickenlooper, who left office in January, has resisted the pull. He calls himself an extreme moderate, and in his announcement video on Monday, touted his ability to work with Republicans.
I'm running for president because we need dreamers in Washington, but we also need to get things done. I've proven again and again I can bring people together to produce the progressive change Washington has failed to deliver. Join me, and we'll repair the damage done to our country and be stronger than ever.
A brew pub owner before being elected mayor of Denver, and then served 8 years as governor, he's focusing on his pro-business record. He is the 14th Democrat to join the field. Banta Berkland is a reporter with Colorado Public Radio and joined us now. Banta, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you.
Well, Hickenlooper's announcement wasn't a surprise. People in Colorado have known for a long time he was likely to run. But tell the rest of us who John Hickenlooper is.
I think the video did a great job of capturing the major pieces of his life story. He started out as a businessman. Before that, he was a geologist, and he was laid off. And he frequently talks about how that did change his perspective on life when he was without a job and didn't know what he was going to do career-wise. He started Denver's first microbrew pub, very successful, and it did help revitalize a neighborhood in Denver, which is a city that's thriving. Got into politics, was mayor of Denver, has been mayor, governor for 8 years. I've covered him since he's been at the Capitol, so for the last 8 years. I would say that he's someone that's very likable. He's got a folksy, relatable demeanor, and even people who disagreed with him strongly on policy issues would say, look, we still think he's a good guy.
Well, you spoke with him on Monday. When you spend time with him, what do you learn about him? What do you come away with?
One thing that stood out to me in his video and announcement, and even during my interview with him, was he used the word progressive a lot to talk about progressive change and progressive values. That's not something we've really heard from him the last 8 years in Colorado. I don't think people here would think of him as a progressive governor. And sometimes it's hard to get a read on what he thinks on certain bills. He was a little bit hands-off at the state legislature. He said he didn't like to micromanage lawmakers, and he felt sometimes by speaking boldly on an initiative or something like that, it could make it harder to get a compromise accomplished. So he did do a lot of negotiations and bringing people to the table behind the scenes, but it could be tough to pin him down until he wanted to say how he was going to decide. That's a little bit different from our current governor, who's come out on a lot of controversial things already and said, I'll sign this, I won't sign that.
Having covered him for 8 years, what would you say were his biggest accomplishments and his biggest failures?
There's this phrase that sometimes your greatest strength is your greatest weakness. And I think that could be the case here. He does a great job of bringing people to the table and really listening to a lot of different perspectives. And he's talked a lot over the years about how that's a very important principle for him, is making people feel heard and understanding where they're coming from. That can really tone down some of the anger when people have that really productive dialogue. And Hickenlooper's great at doing that, and I think a lot of people respect him for having that process. For people on the left, Democrats, especially people who are more liberal than him, I think there was a lot of frustration that when they cared passionately about a certain issue, sometimes they wanted the governor to be more out front on that issue, to help them build support on it. I'll point to the stricter gun laws he signed. That was in 2013. a few months after the Aurora Theater shooting here at a movie theater outside of Denver. And he signed those bills. And he's right, we were a purple state, and that was a really tough thing for him to do. It led to two Democratic lawmakers being recalled from office, the first time in state history, the Senate president. The next election cycle, Republicans took control of our state Senate. But after those bills were signed by him, he didn't really own those bills as a badge of accomplishment. He backtracked and he kind of tried to apologize for it. He's not doing that now on the national stage, but it's things like that that have frustrated people on the left.
Well, in addition to a possible mixed message on guns, there was also a mixed message on the environment. I know that there were a lot of environmentalists who gave him a mixed record for his both sides' behavior in the fracking debate.
He wasn't someone who wanted to ban fracking or pass some of the most strict regulations on oil and gas that a lot of Democrats wanted him to do. And so I think that's an area where he may diverge from them. He has brought it up a lot as an accomplishment in terms of these methane rules that he did help negotiate and pass, and that was a big deal. But I think it's pretty clear from what's happening right now in Colorado that Democrats didn't think that goes nearly far enough. There's a huge oil and gas comprehensive change going through the Capitol right now. And the pitch Democrats are making is we haven't had substantive changes in 60 years. So I don't think they feel like his administration made the changes they really want to see.
He talks a lot about working with Republicans in the state legislature. And obviously he has appeal across party lines. If he was elected in 2010 and 2014, those were huge Republican years. So the fact that he was elected in both has to say something about his appeal with Republican voters. But he also talks about working with Republicans in the state legislature. He talks about getting things done. Do you get a sense that's what Democrats want to hear in 2020, that he can get along with Republicans?
I think it's going to be hard to know where that energy is going to evolve. Right now, we are seeing a lot of anger and people are frustrated with Trump. We've seen that in Colorado, which Democrats had a sweeping electoral success last November. So I think that remains to be seen. Some people don't want to just fight anger with anger, though, and other people may like a different approach. They want someone who can look at the big picture, take in all the different sides. You know, I was saying before, some people may want him more out front on issues. Others may think, look, we want a president who's going to take advice from a lot of people, not rush to judgment. And so I think it'll depend. I think that's the really good thing, that there's going to be this big Democratic primary. It will give the nation and Democrats a sense to see who rises to the top and what people are feeling. I think he's going to have a different type of energy than some of the other candidates. He's known for being pretty upbeat and makes jokes and, you know, just has generally a good demeanor. That's who he is.
When you talk about the large Democratic field, I mean, now with him in the race, it's up to 14. And I think the predictable, and sometimes it's almost a tiresome question about every candidate is like, you know, well, how would you say he stands out in the pack? But when I ask that question, and when I think of that question, knowing that he's kind of a centrist, I also know that there's a possible entry of Joe Biden and Beto O'Rourke and Senator Sherrod Brown and Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana, you know, the killer bees. But they're all kind of, many of them are also moderates. So it'll be a very crowded field for him.
I think so. I mean, I think that's the lane he's trying to walk through. And he'll even say this, his biggest challenge is he's not well known. He's not on the national stage. He's gone out to a lot of, you know, primary states already, and he's very determined, but he doesn't have the name ID of someone like Biden. And so if those people enter the race, I think it's going to be tough for someone like Hickenlooper and other candidates like him.
And speaking of killer bees, because I mentioned all those candidates with bees, his former chief of staff is Michael Bennett, the Colorado senator, and he too is thinking about running.
Yes, we've been working on that story, and I think Bennett's seriously considering a run for president, and we will know something very soon. They are good friends. Our sources confirm that Bennett did talk to Hickenlooper about it pretty early on, because they go back a long time. And so I think that'll be interesting. But people feel like, you know, just because you're from Colorado, they don't have the same message. You know, one's a U.S. senator, one's a governor. They're going to have different approaches. So I think people don't feel like it's going to be a problem.
Right now, he's trying to raise money. He's trying to build a staff. Any progress on that front, as far as you can tell?
I think so, yeah. What we've just found out from his Giddy Up PAC is that the Hickenlooper campaign has raised over $1 million in less than 48 hours. And, you know, he's got some great staff members, and they say he's one of only four Democratic primary candidates to reach that level of early support. And they say they've got donations from all 50 states, and he's not accepting corporate PAC money. So I think we'll just have to see how his message resonates. I mean, another positive he has going for him is Colorado's doing very well economically. And I think we have a strong state brand, and there's a lot of accomplishments he can point to that happened while he was governor.
Wow, you mentioned the Giddy Up PAC. I mean, that sounds so West. It sounds so Western.
And I think that's very intentional. He says this is what sets him apart from so many of these other Democratic opponents who've spent long careers in Washington engaged in what he called a debate of words. And he said he's been focusing on making this state function and putting teams together of very talented people and getting things done.
Benta Berkland is a reporter with Colorado Public Radio. Benta, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
And now to Washington, that other Washington. Governor Jay Inslee announced his candidacy a week ago, Friday. And just in case people don't know what issue is atop his list.
Hi, Governor. What do you have to say about climate change?
A lot.
We have got to stop global warming.
Everyone in this country knows
climate is changing.
Reduce carbon pollution.
New energy future.
Climate change.
Climate change.
We should be dealing with climate change.
Climate change.
Climate change.
We need to defeat climate change.
That's what I believe.
I'm Jay Inslee, and I'm running for president because I'm the only candidate who will make defeating climate change our nation's number one priority. We can do this.
Well, you know his issue. Now it's time to learn about him. Austin Jenkins is a political reporter with the Northwest News Network, a collaboration of public radio stations in Washington and Oregon. Austin, it's great having you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
Well, earlier in the show, we were talking about Colorado's John Hickenlooper, the most recent candidate to get in the race. And some people wonder if Hick has the passion to compete in this race. There's no question what Jay Inslee is passionate about.
He is sort of single-heartedly and relentlessly and constantly on message about climate change. And I've described Jay Inslee is sort of a cross between an end times preacher and a Labrador retriever. He wraps up this topic of climate change and global warming and this peril that we face in a very upbeat, we can do it, mission to the moon kind of rhetoric.
Well, you know, there have been so-called one-issue candidates in the past who arouse followers with speeches about wealth or war or race, but climate change and the environment have moved up as something voters are more and more concerned about.
Well, this is a guy who has been talking about this for two decades, and eventually I think he thinks he's going to wake up and the rest of the country will have arrived where he was two decades ago. And I think that he believes that that moment has come, that finally the timing is right, that this issue is more front and center. It is trending higher in polls. It's more on the minds of the public. He says, you know, it's no longer a chart on a graph, but it's forest fire smoke choking out kids trying to swim in the pools in central Washington, or ash on the hood of a car. I mean, you can tell I've heard his stump speech so many times now. Ash on the hood of the cars in Seattle, or, you know, rising sea level in Miami, floods and hurricanes and so forth. So he does think that the time is right. I also think he realizes that being a governor from who's not well known, from a state that, you know, to some extent we are very much on the map. We're the home of Microsoft and Amazon and Starbucks, but we're still not a well-known political state, that he feels this is his only way, his only avenue to being a contender is to run on a single issue and to stand out from the crowd in this fashion.
Well, I mean, that's not a bad idea, given the fact that there are 14 candidates in the race. It's not bad to be known as the climate change candidate.
He's also arguing that this is not really a single issue, but it's an umbrella issue that captures a lot of topics, from jobs and opportunity with the clean energy revolution, as he calls it, all the way to national security. And he talks about desertification and the potential for mass migration and what impacts that would have on borders and national security and even, you know, wars and famine. So he's trying to sell this as an all-encompassing issue rather than something that is very narrow or sort of a sidebar issue.
How successful has he been as governor to implement his climate change goals?
It hasn't been easy for him. Keep in mind when he's a two-term Democratic governor who was elected at a time when we had split control in the legislature, Republicans controlling the state Senate. He was declared to be, at the time of his inauguration, by Dennis Hayes, who was one of the organizers of the first Earth Day, to be the first governor elected principally on a platform of addressing climate change. Now, when I heard that on Inauguration Day back in 2013, it didn't jibe with what I remembered Inslee talking about necessarily on the campaign trail. But it was certainly true that going forward, Inslee was trying to implement climate-related policies. The first thing he did is he created a climate legislative work group, bipartisan in nature. And it was just clear from the beginning that the Republicans were not going to play in the sandbox with him on this. So he had a cap and trade proposal, and then he had a carbon tax proposal, and none of this was getting through the legislature. Republicans put up roadblocks, but it wasn't like Democrats in the House were falling all over themselves to get this stuff passed. Then we've had two carbon taxes / fees on the ballot, both rejected by Washington voters. But now he's got Democratic majorities in both chambers, and he's got a different approach. Instead of pricing carbon, he's got what he calls his golden buckshot approach, which includes a 100% clean electricity bill and some other things. And it seems like there's momentum this year to give him some wins, finally, after all these years, on climate-related policy.
Well, how do Republicans see him as a political leader?
You know, I don't think that he has earned the trust and respect of Republicans in the state house. He's not the kind of governor that gets people into a room, as his predecessor Chris Gregoire did, and says, nobody's leaving until we have a deal. He is someone who Republicans here in the state have said that this is a vanity run for the presidency, and if he really wants to do this, he should resign as governor. They've kind of mocked what he's doing. And then there are Republicans in the state house who've gone toe-to-toe with him over a climate related legislation, who say that he is a climate warrior, that he's not only singularly focused, but that he sees government as the solution, and what he ought to do is get out of the way and let the private sector address our carbon pollution issues and design our next generation energy sources, and that he just always wants to default to a government solution, and that's, you know, not the right answer, and he ought to get out of the way. And you hear that a lot from Republicans who have gone toe-to-toe with him over his climate-related policies.
That's funny, because I don't remember Republicans saying that George W. Bush or Scott Walker should have resigned as governor when they were running for president.
It's a fair point, and you're right. And it's not unprecedented to have sitting governors running for president. And this governor says they invented the cell phone for a reason. He can do both jobs, even when he's traveling.
He could walk and chew gum at the same time, right?
Right.
Are there any other signature issues he's focusing on?
You know, if you just go back over his tenure here as governor, and then issues he's talking about in interviews as he pivots to this national campaign, he's talking about things like marijuana legalization, something that Washington State did at the ballot box. He, in his announcement speech announcing his bid for president, talked about the fact that marijuana should be legalized nationally. He often actually talks about things Washington State has done at the ballot box by initiative, like raising the minimum wage, legalizing marijuana. He takes credit for a lot of things, but you know, some of them were done by voters, not by the legislature or by his signing a bill. You know, one of the first things he did as a governor is he implemented a moratorium on the death penalty, Subsequently, the state Supreme Court here has found our death penalty statute unconstitutional, and now the legislature is looking at whether to just repeal it altogether. So he's taken a lead on issues like that, and he's certainly talking about progressive worker-friendly policies, paid family leave as an example. I mentioned higher minimum wage. Policies he says he thinks would play well nationally that could be exported from Washington State to the other Washington.
How popular is he at home?
You know, he's a popular governor. He's been elected twice. He has struggled in the past to keep his favorability numbers up. Look, Republicans are not a big fan of this governor, and they had one chamber of the legislature for a number of years, and they made it clear that they were going to be the counter to this governor. And, you know, he struggled. He struggled to get policies past the legislature. He's very good at grabbing onto the bully pulpit and making pronouncements and taking on the president, getting legislation across the finish line, maybe not his strong suit. And in that sense, I think that voters have looked at him and said, you know, he's often described as Sunny Jay here by other reporters. You know, he's got this reputation as sort of an upbeat, cheerful guy who's got the soaring rhetoric and a pretty sunny disposition, but not always able to get the ball across the finish line.
Well, the next task for him is to raise money, hire staff, and get some national recognition. Of course, with 14 candidates in the race, that's not going to be easy.
It's not going to be easy, but you know, he's had a pretty good few days right out of the gates. Raised $1 million in the first weekend since he announced. It's not the $10 million that Bernie Sanders raised in a week, but given where Jay Inslee is starting, $1 million is nothing to sneeze at. He's now got a super PAC behind him. It's putting him in a little bit of an awkward spot because there's progressive groups that are saying he should disavow and distance himself, but he's probably not going to do that because he needs the $1 million they're spending in Iowa and elsewhere now to get his name ID up. He's done a bunch of national interviews, and they've been favorable. They've also been friendly for the most part. But, you know, out of the gates, he seems to be getting positive press, and he's getting some notice. And everybody I talk to, and you would know better than me, Ken, but would say that this is an open nomination at this point. And as a lone sitting governor in a race that's dominated right now by a bunch of U.S. senators, he's able to distinguish himself just by virtue of the seat he occupies.
Austin Jenkins is a political reporter with the Northwest News Network based in Olympia, Washington. Austin, it's great having you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You poisoned my sweet water. You cut down my green trees. The food you fed my children was the
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last former governor to get elected to the House? The answer, Charlie Crist, the Republican governor of Florida who quit the GOP and ran as an independent during a failed 2010 Senate bid. Crist was elected to the House in 2016 as a Democrat and still serves. And the randomly selected winner is Curtis Tribble. Curtis wins the coveted political junkie button. And stay tuned for the next Scuttlebutton puzzle. It goes up on our website this weekend. You can find that as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Charlie says, love my good and plenty. Charlie says, really rings the bell. Charlie says,
with about 340 or so days to go before New Hampshire's first in the nation primary, there's a new poll out that shows Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden in the lead among Democrats. The Granite State poll, conducted by the University of New Hampshire Survey Center, had Sanders with 26%, Biden at 22%, Kamala Harris at 10, Elizabeth Warren at 7, and Beto O'Rourke at 5. Biden and Beto have yet to announce their candidacy. There are also numbers on the Republican side, which doesn't get talked about as much, and probably with good reason. President Trump holds a commanding lead over potential opponents John Kasich, the former governor of Ohio, and Bill Weld, who served 8 years as Massachusetts governor. Trump has 68% in the poll. Kasich, who has yet to announce his intentions, had 17, and Weld, who announced an exploratory committee last month, had 3. Take these numbers with a grain of salt. We've got a year to go. But I want to stay on the GOP for a second. New Hampshire voters have always had an interesting relationship with Republican presidents. When the commander-in-chief is popular, think Eisenhower in 56, Nixon in 72, Reagan in 84, George W. Bush in 2004, they sail through the primaries with little effort. But when their polling numbers are iffy, the Granite State can be punishing. Gerry Ford barely got by Ronald Reagan in 76, and George H.W. Bush had trouble with Pat Buchanan in 92. At this point, President Trump remains popular with his fellow Republicans. At this point. For a snapshot of this point in New Hampshire, we have Fergus Cullen on the program. He's the former GOP state chair in New Hampshire and author of the book Granite Steps, Stumbles, Surprises, and Successes on the New Hampshire Primary Trail. Fergus, it's great having you back on the Political Junkie.
Thanks so much, Ken. I appreciate it.
With those University of New Hampshire polling numbers I just recited, do they sound right to you?
They do. And, you know, one of the interesting things on the Republican side is they show that, you know, some 40 to 50% of Republican primary voters say they are open to a challenger to President Trump. That doesn't mean that all those people are going to vote for a challenger, but they'd like to see a contest. They're willing to hear somebody else out. And so there is a potential market for a challenger against the incumbent. And history shows whenever a challenger runs against an incumbent president, it is a bad sign for the incumbent. 5 times since World War II, an incumbent president has been challenged in the New Hampshire primary by at least a competitive challenger, and all 5 times that incumbent president did not end up reelected. Sometimes they were defeated in a general, sometimes they chose to retire, which is what happened with Lyndon Johnson, for example, in 1968.
And Harry Truman.
And you mentioned the Ford election in 76, Jimmy Carter in 1980, and then George H.W. Bush in 1992. The lesson is, if you draw a serious challenger, you don't end up being reelected.
Well, let's go back to the two candidates who were listed, the two potential candidates listed in that poll. In 2016, John Kasich finished second to Trump in New Hampshire, who beat him better than 2-1. But he finished second. Does he have any residual good feelings among Republican voters?
He does. And, you know, I was a Kasich supporter 2 years ago, and he has kept in touch with his New Hampshire supporters. He was here most recently, I think, in December, and I was one of many people who met with him at that time. I take Governor Kasich at his word that he's open to the possibility of running again, hasn't made up a final decision, probably going to take at least a couple more months to do it. So there, you know, there is some good feelings towards him. One lesson I take from the 1992 challenge when Pat Buchanan ran, that was a 10-week campaign. Buchanan only announced his candidacy in the first week of December, and he ended up with 37% of the vote. So it's not the kind of thing that you grind it out for 12 or 18 months on the campaign trail and build support. Challenges happen late, they break late, it's all a big wave of momentum at the end. You know, half the people who voted for Buchanan really believed in him, liked his policies, and supported him. But the other half were just using him as a vehicle to send a message that they were unhappy with the Bush administration for whatever reason. And, you know, I believe that a similar kind of potential electorate exists for a challenger against Donald Trump. Maybe they're in favor of that particular candidate, or maybe they're just using that person as a vehicle to send a message that they're unhappy with the tone of this administration or its policies or anything like that.
Going to Bill Weld, he announced his exploratory committee in New Hampshire last month. Has he been campaigning in the state since then?
Well, he's made a couple of trips. He's gone to mostly the colleges at this point. I had the opportunity to have a one-on-one meeting with Governor Weld when he was here a couple weeks ago. I appreciated it. Look, you know, people, there aren't a lot of Republicans who have been elected to statewide office in my part of the country in New England. And when Governor Weld was elected in Massachusetts in 1990, it was a breakthrough for Republicans. He showed that it could be done. And then he was reelected in Massachusetts in 1994 by a wide margin and gave inspiration to lots of other candidates who had success in other states. I think people sometimes forget that. But he is starting to make the rounds in sort of more traditional campaign style, and I may be involved in his upcoming trip later this month in that way.
Of course, it's important to mention that he also deserted the Republican Party in 2016 when he ran as the vice president on the Libertarian Party ticket. And when that wasn't going so well, he urged people to vote for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, he's absolutely been in different places politically. I would just suggest that President Trump has not exactly been a paragon of Republican virtue or consistency over the years. I mean, he's changed parties five times, has obviously contributed to many Democrats, including some running against him now, including Kamala Harris, for example. So if it's going to come down to ideology, we'll see who's the real conservative. But I don't think that's what a primary challenge is going to be about. I mean, President Trump, you know, calls himself a conservative. I think that most philosophical conservatives would probably disagree with that. I just don't think it's going to come down to ideology.
But sticking on that subject for 1 second, it's also fair to say that Bill Weld is pro-choice and pro-gay rights, and those are not conservative party, Republican Party philosophy either.
Well, maybe not nationally, but here in the Northeast, tends to be much more secular. You know, pro-choice Republican candidates tend to be the kinds who win statewide races. You know, it's a different kind of electorate, and that's not going to disqualify him with a lot of voters.
And I'm also thinking the fact that he's from Massachusetts. New Hampshire has often been a good place for Massachusetts presidential candidates. Paul Tsongas and John Kerry won here. Mitt Romney lost in 2008, but he won 4 years later. Henry Cabot Lodge won you know, he was thousands of miles away in Saigon in 1964, but he won it, and it was on a write-in. So it's not terrible to be from nearby Massachusetts, right?
No, I mean, the Boston media market dominates New Hampshire. Many tens of thousands of people in New Hampshire live in New Hampshire but work in Massachusetts. We root for the Red Sox. I know you're sorry to hear that, Ken, but it's true. You know, we're oriented towards Boston in a lot of ways, and so voters here tend to be more familiar with candidates from Massachusetts.
Wait. Did you hear that sound? Did I just hang up on you? No.
Defending World Series champs, in case you forgot.
No, that's true. No, they're a great team, and I wish them all the well. I'm teasing.
I know. You're probably going to edit that out.
No, I will not, because I am fair and balanced. Anyway, one more quick question, though. Do you think other candidates, you mentioned earlier that there was an appetite, a possible appetite for other candidates to get into the race. There's been talk about Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. He was in Iowa last week chatting with folks. Have you heard anything about his possible candidacy?
Well, he has not, to the best of my knowledge, been making proactive calls into the state to Republican leaders or anything like that. And again, I remind you that these kinds of candidacies, these challengers, they tend to break late. But I do think Bill Weld, one of the reasons he's starting to make the rounds is to encourage and give courage to other candidates who might be thinking the same thing. He's sticking his neck out. He knows that. And he's hoping that he won't be alone on the campaign trail. So, you know, I think that's the part of the purpose of his candidacy. And I suspect other people will start making visits, you know, sometime between now and the summer.
Fergus Cullen is the former chairman of the Republican Party of New Hampshire and a Red Sox fan. Fergus, it was great having you on the program despite what I just said.
Thank you so much, Ken. I appreciate it again.
You can try to please me, but it won't be easy.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week. 'Cause my heart is stone. You better leave me alone.